I'm going to move House File 1720 then, which is my bill. It's just a very simple bill, and would like Mr. Flannery from the Arts Herbert Jar School to come up. And we'll just take this one real quickly. I move House File 1720 for consideration for the K-12 Omnibus Bill. Members, basically what this bill would do would add the Purpich Center for the Arts as someone who would be eligible to sponsor charter schools. Academies of their classification are not able to do that, and they have been approached to from time to time to be a sponsor and to look at some partnerships with other arts organizations and establishing some other opportunities for students that are outside of the grade level that they serve. And Mr. Flannery, I will let you speak real briefly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is David Flannery. I'm the Interim Executive Director of the Purpich Center for Arts Education, and with me is the Deputy Director, Pam Paulson. A little more than a year ago, we were approached by a small charter school in southwestern Minnesota, close to New Ulm, the Hanska Elementary School. And because Hanska is in a Norwegian community and focused on Norwegian music and dance and folk arts, they felt they were looking, the New Ulm system dropped them as a sponsoring organization. They weren't going to sponsor them again. And they asked us, because of our experience with arts education and integrating the arts into academics, whether or not we would be a sponsor. At about the same time, we were approached by the Gates Foundation. They were interested in starting small schools, small high schools, that were arts-centered high schools. And they knew that we had experience with that, and they wondered if we were interested in building a model and trying to promote that model and work with school districts and others. So we began talking about whether or not that would help us with our mission, which is to improve K-12 education through a focus on the arts. And the more we discussed it with our board and our faculty and our administration, the more we thought that being a sponsoring agency with a single purpose to develop and to help organizations and school districts develop art-centered schools might really work for us as a sponsor to help us with our mission. And it may really work for the organizations that want to improve education for children. And so we explored the idea of becoming a sponsor. We looked into it. We talked to people from the Department of Education. We talked to people from the Charter School Association. We talked to superintendents from some school districts that were interested. And there was a general consensus that we would be a good sponsor. We need to learn. We need to develop the appropriate skills and tools to be a responsible sponsor, but we think that we could do that. We would like to do that. The only thing that we have in front of us at this time is we expect to get asked by the Hanska School, if it continues, to sponsor them for the next few years. Currently, they are sponsored by the Department of Education, and they went into that sponsorship with the idea that at the end of a year, they would seek out another sponsor. So it is possible that they would ask us and that we would consider it. But in the future, we would like to take a look at building a partnership with school districts or arts organizations or anyone interested in developing an arts-centered secondary school or elementary school. We would like to partner with and see if we could work something out. But right now, the only thing that we know is that we will be approached, we think, this spring by the Hanska School.
All right. So there would be no fiscal cost to that then to the
school? It would be a relatively small cost to the center, which we would absorb.
All right. And would you like to make some comments, too?
My name is Pam Paulson. I'm the Deputy Director of the Purpich Center. And the area in which I had the most contact most recently is the Gates Foundation. And the Gates Foundation is interested in schools like the Purpich Center because we have a clear, focused model, and we also have a small student body and a lot of individual attention. So when we were working with them, it was very clear that we would fit into a category of sponsored, developed kinds of charter schools where we might have a model we could put together based on our experience in starting a school. and share with other schools in our state. So they're excited about us as a model, and I think we've got something to offer.
Great. Are there any questions of the committee, or from the committee? Mr. Flannery, one comment, and then we need
just
to move on.
One final comment. We're developing a fiscal impact statement with the Department of Finance.
Actually,
and
Mr. Flannery, we've got the
you've got it already?
Yes,
okay. Good.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
I don't see Representative Klinzing. Could the page maybe okay, someone's gone up to get her. Okay, I don't want to hold this over. Why don't we go ahead and Representative Knobloch is not here. I'm trying to maybe clear up some of the ones that would get done more quickly. Why don't we go ahead then with the Colin Powell? Are the people here from the Colin Powell? No? No. Okay. All right. Then let's have Mr. Bob Wadle, who... this is actually was a nice segue. Mr. Flannery mentioned wanting to know how to do sponsoring. And over the summer, there was a group of folks that got together, existing sponsors and charter school folks, and Mr. Wadle, I guess, can share who all those people were, to try to develop a guideline for sponsorship and kind of hammer out some of the duties, and we think that this will be something that would be very helpful as people are interested in sponsoring to kind of lay out what they would be looking at as a sponsor. And Mr. Wadle, if you would like to go ahead, and we'll...
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Bob Wadle. I work with a group called Education Evolving, and I'm representing Education Evolving today. As you know, Minnesota was the first state in the nation to enact chartering legislation back in the early 90s, and now 40 states plus the District of Columbia have charter school legislation. There's about 3,000 schools around the country with about 700,000 students. And right now, Minnesota has 88 schools, and that will be expanding to over 100 next year and also in 2005 based on the number that have been approved to this point. But in order for a school to be granted a charter, it has to have a sponsor, or in some cases, some states are called authorizer, but it's basically the same thing. Minnesota has 9 different organizations that may sponsor chartered schools. And right now, we have 66 different sponsors of our charter schools. So it's very evident that the vast majority of schools are sponsors just do one or two, or just a handful. Although the St. Paul Public Schools has 8 schools right now, the Department of Education has 12. Some of the nonprofits, Volunteers of America, for example, has 8. The university system, Hamlin, has 5. So some of them do sponsor more than one or two, but the vast majority basically are single charter sponsors. And one reason for that is that sponsoring charters is not their primary mission. Of course, their mission is something else. And so while they're going off on the business of doing what their primary mission is, they also engage in some sponsorship. Well, over the last 13 years or since the enactment of the legislation, virtually all of the focus has been actually on the chartered schools themselves, and that's very reasonable. But very little focus has been on what is the role of the sponsor. And Education Evolving really believes that a greater focus must be placed on the sponsor as a way to improve the schools that are initiated. And really for three reasons. One is it's the sponsor that actually grants the charter. Not the commissioner, not the legislature. The sponsor under current Minnesota law is the organization that grants the charter. It's the sponsor's responsibility to provide the oversight, and which that includes assistance, etc. But it's the sponsor, not the commissioner, the sponsor that provides the oversight. And also then, it's the sponsor that's responsible for making the decision whether or not to renew the charter or to terminate that charter. So the sponsor has major responsibilities. Sometimes the sponsors don't realize that when they first get into the business of sponsoring. But this chart, for example, shows all of the major responsibilities that the sponsor actually has. So I'm going to walk through each of these boxes very, very briefly. But many times it's the kind of the conception, oh, the sponsor, doesn't have that much to do. And its responsibilities are kind of signing off on the application, and then 3 years later trying to determine whether or not the school should continue. But the charter has major responsibilities.
Mr. Wadle, yes. Just wanted to point out, you've got in your packet this book that would be helpful. And on page 13 is the what he has up on the screen, in case you're like me and can't quite read those words. It is in this book on page 13.
One of the first decisions that the sponsor has to make is whether or not it should be a sponsor. And the guide addresses how sponsors can go about making that decision. We're suggesting that the sponsor should take a look at, is sponsoring a chartered school one way for the sponsor to carry out its mission? For example, some of the Audubon Society, obviously their mission is to enhance the environment, etc., has decided that sponsoring a few charter schools is one way for it to actually carry out its mission. Another thing the sponsor has to consider, it doesn't have the capacity to be a sponsor. So this guide that we put together, kind of lays out all of the responsibilities so the sponsor clearly recognizes what it is getting into. Third, the sponsor needs to determine whether or not it has the necessary resources to be a sponsor. And that includes people that can be involved in the review of applications, doing the oversight, providing assistance to the sponsor if that's part of the arrangement. But the sponsor has to have the capability and the resources to be able to do that. And then the sponsor needs to have the long-time commitment or the long-term commitment. So it's not just something that you do just initially in terms of application review. So we're saying that then once you decide that you're going to be a sponsor, then you should be informing others about the fact that you are going to be a sponsor. In the law that you enacted in the early 90s, you specified that sponsors, especially urban sponsors, need to be communicating with other organizations, with communities of color, of their interest in being a sponsor. So we're putting into place ways for sponsors to let others know that they are willing to be sponsors. Another thing that we point out in the sponsoring guide is that there are really two kinds of models of sponsoring. One is what we call the operator design model. And that's the model that most charters have been started around. A group of folks, teachers, parents, whomever, get together, put together a proposal, and then they go out and search for a sponsor. So that's called the operator design model, where the, for the folks that are going to run the school, put the design together. The other kind, the other model is what we call a sponsor design model, where the sponsor determines the model and then seeks the best operator. So under the operator determines the model and seeks the best sponsor. Under the sponsor design model, the sponsor determines the model and seeks the best operator. And we're suggesting that school district sponsors really ought to be looking at this second part, where the school district would say, these are the kinds of schools that we want. Who will be the best operator? Who will give us the best proposal to operate one of these schools within our district? For example, I think the testimony that you just heard, if you would add the art school to the sponsoring category, they would be a sponsored design model where they would say, here are the characteristics of the schools that we want to sponsor. Who's interested in actually operating one of these arts types of schools that we will then work with you to implement. So we really believe that in the future we're going to be seeing more sponsor design models where the sponsor looks at chartering as one way for it to carry out its role. So that's why I referenced school districts. School districts have varying types of management options now. They don't have to own and operate all of the schools within the district. So the school board should look at sponsoring where under a sponsor design model as one way for it to carry out its responsibility to educate the children of that district. Well, then the manual goes on to talk about the things that the sponsor should look at when it actually does get applications. And one is a pre-application phase. We're suggesting that sponsors really include in their procedures that they really want to meet with potential operators at the very beginning. So it's not something that at the last minute an application comes in and the sponsor has to decide whether they're going to sponsor it. But they should be looking at or meeting with the operators at the very beginning and granting information as to the kind of schools that they will sponsor and providing assistance in the application phase. Then once we get the application, then the guide goes through and identifies what are some of the real key points that you want to make sure are very, very articulated very well in the application. Obviously, it needs to meet the state and sponsors' standards. Some of the sponsors have standards in addition to those that you require. For example, Volunteers of America has included in their standards that part of the schools that they sponsor must have a service learning component. So the sponsor also can add requirements to the kind of schools that it will sponsor. So when you're reviewing the application, we've got a section dealing with how do you determine that you really have a strong operator who understands the kind of business that they're getting into, that the proposal has a clear sense of purpose, that's very well articulated, that there's a high-quality program design, either a strong research-based program design or one that has certainly strong background in terms of the rationale for it. That have a valid evaluation design. The manual goes into quite extensively regarding what kind of evaluation design the sponsor should be looking at. Then that it has competent governance. That the board should include legal counsel, should include somebody with a good finance background, in addition to all the other characteristics. That have a sound financial plan. Assuming that the charter is then that the sponsor agrees to grant the charter, then it needs to be approved by the commissioner, and then following approval by the commissioner, then the sponsor and the charter need to put together a contract. And so the manual goes into detail as to what the substance of that contract should be. And obviously it needs to include the provisions in law, but also it needs to include the sponsor's requirements, the No Child Left Behind provisions, because No Child Left Behind federal law specifically speaks to the role of the sponsor in terms of providing oversight regarding No Child Left Behind. So the contract needs to very clearly lay out what are the expectations that the sponsor is looking for from the school, how is it going to provide oversight, what kind of assistance will the sponsor provide, what kind of fees will be charged for sponsorship, and those types of details. Then in terms of the oversight responsibilities, we're suggesting that the sponsor have a relationship with the Department of Education in terms of getting access to all the reports that the department has on school districts. And those would include things like special education monitoring reports, or if a school has been in statutory operating debt, those reports and those plans. So one of the things that we're suggesting to sponsors is make sure that you're accessing all of the reports that the department has. We're saying communicate regularly with the charter school board. Attend meetings frequently, have on the agenda of the chartered school, on the agenda of the chartered school board, a place for sponsor reports and communication. We're saying conduct on-site observations regularly. Meet with parents and students and faculty. And then gather data. One of the requirements is an annual report. Make sure that you're looking at the student achievement information, parent, staff, and student surveys, and other kinds of information that will provide a good basis for making decisions as to how well the chartered school is carrying out its mission. And then the renewal process, the guide really emphasizes that renewal decisions should not come at the end of 3 years, that the oversight process on an ongoing basis should provide the information that the sponsor needs for making the renewal decisions. And also we're suggesting that as part of the process that the school develop at least annual improvement plans so that it is in the continuous improvement cycle. But for the renewal process, the sponsor would review the performance of students and management, and that includes the financial management, prepares a written report, submits that report to the commissioner for review and comment, as is required by law, and then makes the decision as to whether or not it's going to renew the charter for a three-year term or for less than a three-year term based on the findings of this review, or whether it's going to terminate the charter contract. And the law actually provides that termination can occur either within the term of the within the three-year term of the contract or at the end of the contract. But the guide then goes through about how those types of decisions can be made. And then the final thing is that it does inform sponsors that you can get out of the responsibility of sponsoring. And if you have decided that you're not going to continue sponsoring, not for cause, but you're just are no longer going to be a sponsor, that you should be giving your schools adequate notice of that, that you're no longer going to be their sponsor, so that they can find a new sponsor. Or sometimes a school that's a chartered school determines that a different sponsor has a mission that's more closely aligned with that school, so it would want to move from one sponsor to another. That type of movement has to be approved by the commissioner, and we're suggesting that current sponsors would want to provide the commissioner with information as to how well that school is doing before the commissioner would approve a transfer from one sponsor to another. Or in some cases, the school simply says, we're not going to continue operating as a school. So that would be another reason why, of course, the sponsor would not renew the sponsorship. From here, we are going to be disseminating this manual on Friday at the Minnesota Association of Charter School Conference. We will be having a session for sponsors. But then we will also be doing training for sponsors through the rest of this year. And Education Evolving has a grant from the St. Paul Foundation. And I want to thank the St. Paul Foundation for providing that grant. And part of that grant is being used to finance a cadre of folks that will be able to provide assistance to sponsors as they really move forward from here to develop their own procedures following the sponsor's guide for how they are going to really operate more effectively as a sponsor. So those are some of the things coming down the road. Madam Chair and members, I would like to ask Chaz Anderson from the Department of Education and Joe Nathan from the Center for School Change and Steve Dess from the Association, Minnesota Association of Charter Schools, just to contribute a few comments as to how they will be using this sponsor's guide as they carry out their work.
Mr. Waddell, I think Marianne Nelson, Assistant Commissioner Marianne Nelson, is going to take Ms. Anderson's place on that.
Okay.
And then if Mr. Dess wants to come down, too, we want to move ahead. We really have a tight schedule today, so if you can keep your comments brief. In the back of the of this booklet is some letters of endorsement from different people. I wanted the committee to know that this work had been going on and had been addressing some of the questions about, you know, how do we get responsible sponsors involved in this chartering process. Ms. Nelson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, on behalf of Commissioner Yeki, I want to congratulate Education Evolving on the publication of its resource guide for sponsors of public school in Minnesota, and also thank them for seeking input on its development from the Department of Education. In June 2003, the Office of the Legislative Auditor in Minnesota issued a report on, and here's the title, Charter School Financial Accountability. It included a recommendation that, and I read in quotes, the Minnesota Department of Education should initiate a process to more clearly define the scope and nature of the sponsor's role regarding charter school financial management. At that time, department staff had already begun a series of meetings with key stakeholders to develop a plan for increasing the effectiveness of sponsors, and that effort soon merged with Education Evolving's project to develop a guide on recommended practice for sponsors. It should be noted that as a result of additional training and other efforts by staff at the department and charter school resource groups, the financial picture for charter schools continues to improve. For instance, while 16% of the 56 charter schools open in 2000 were in statutory operating debt, only two of the 89 current charter schools were in statutory operating debt last year, and we think that's a significant improvement. However, the benefits of the sponsorship guide go beyond financial accountability to the even more important issue of academic results. You will notice the guide places a special emphasis on the sponsor's ongoing oversight of student academic performance and its determination of whether a school has met specified academic goals before deciding whether to renew its charter. We look forward to working with the other organizations represented here to jointly promote the usage of this guide by existing, new, and prospective sponsors. The department supports this collaborative approach because it will focus on setting high expectations for sponsors, whereas additional legislation, by its nature, might tend to settle for minimal requirements. Overall, we are optimistic that the resource guide will be a key ingredient in yielding high-quality sponsorship, strengthening accountability in charter schools, and providing more excellent public education options for Minnesota children, their parents, and families.
Ms.
Nelson. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Steve Dess, Director of the Charter School Association. This manual has not been developed in isolation. Charter Schools and the Charter School Executive Committee of the Association has been assisting in ways that we can. We know that this is going to enhance accountability, and as they came to the end of their work at this point with the manual, we were so excited that we gave them all Friday, and I checked the records, and about half of the current sponsors are registered so far to spend the whole day, and as a further statement on our support, we're not charging the sponsors for their meals on Friday.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Joe Nathan. I'm director of the Center for School Change at the Humphrey Institute. For the last 18 years, the center has been involved working with leading legislators from both parties, and I want to say thanks to both members of both parties in this room who have pioneered a kind of a public school education, the charter, post-secondary options, a series of improvements that people literally from all over the world come to see. We recently had some visitors from Japan and Australia. And one of the things that people talk about is the bipartisan nature of the support that's occurred for these kinds of innovations. It's been a pleasure to work with former Commissioner Wadle and others. We think that this is an example of how people from various points of view can come forward, and we thank you for your time and the opportunity to present this. We think this is a valuable guide, but we also think it's one more step that Minnesota is taking to show the nation how things really can be done.
Thank you, Mr. Nathan. We need to move on to our agenda. Mr. Wadle, thank you so very much. We wanted to make sure that the committee knew of this work that had been going on for a number of months, and that this is the document that was a result of that work. And we'll have you coming back up soon, I'm sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Another bill. We want to move back now to our first item on the agenda. We were skipping around because people were not here. I also want to, and I'm saying this in a kind way because I know that people have other committees that they're coming from or going to, and you do get waylaid in between committee work, but our committee does start at 10:15. We hope that we will be starting our committees on time. We haven't been starting until 10:30 at some times because people are coming in late. So I am going to be continuing to start at 10:15. Just encourage you to try to get here as quickly as you can. We have a full agenda, and I'm going to start giving gold stars out to the person who first comes, who gets here first, and the person with the most gold stars at the end of the year, I'm going to take them out to dinner for a free dinner. So there's a little incentive for you to get here on time. Kitty is being instructed to, who earned the first star today? He's not here. The other condition is you have to stay here, too. So rip his gold star away. He only earned it temporarily. Will
Madam Chair?
I think Representative Greiling then will be second, and she'll get the gold star for today because she's still sitting here. Now, it depends on if you stay here. So. All right. I just want to encourage you. I know that people are busy and they've got many, many things, and you may be testifying in other committees on bills, but just want to remind you that we do need to start on time. The next bill we want to, we had a continuation of House Bill 1921, Representative Klinzing's bill. We had some testifiers that were not able to testify last week, and we want to make sure that they have the opportunity to testify. So, Representative Klinzing, if you want to come up to the table, and we'll have Lisa Nentel-Bloom. Is she here? Yes, okay. If you want to come up, and then Mr. Aronson, you can be ready. Thank you, Ms. Bloom, if you'll want to.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Lisa Nentel-Bloom representing Education Minnesota this morning.
I would like to express just a few questions and perhaps concerns regarding House File 1921. The report this morning from Education Evolving was really an interesting one to look at, and actually I think in some ways illustrates a couple of the questions that we still have. We wonder whether Education Minnesota is ready to continue the expansion of charter schools prior to looking toward this accountability, toward this assessment of whether in fact charter schools are truly obtaining their goals. We do know that there was a report by the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and that was certainly helpful, but we also look forward to the results of this work that Education Evolving and the other partners have done. We are not opposed to charter schools. In fact, we're eager to hear of strategies that improve student achievement. We, too, share with the committee the goals to improve student achievement and close the achievement gap. Unfortunately, up to this point in time, however, we've really not had the opportunity to learn from our charter schools the way we had once hoped when they were first created. So we hope that that will continue, that will be a goal that we have the opportunity to gain from their experience as they continue with their challenges in their struggles to improve student achievement. Couple questions. First of all, in regards to the idea of the charitable organizations, we've talked about the fact that these are, you know, charitable organizations, 501c3s, which would have as their primary activity the sponsoring of schools. But we wonder, is it possible that that primary mission might somehow be intersecting with another primary mission? In fact, in the report this morning, one of the things that they said on page 6 was that nonprofits, for example, may see the sponsoring of charter schools as a unique way to carry out the mission. The question we may have is it possible that the nonprofit may also have as a mission the idea of furthering religious belief, for example? And is it possible, then, that we would have a blurring of the separation of church and state? And so we just ask that for your consideration. The next thing that I would mention is the idea of accountability and independent oversight. If we expand so that the Department of Education also can sponsor, it appears to us that there's a conflict. Again, as I was looking through the report this morning, and I looked at the role of the Department of Education, and over and over it was reiterated that they have the challenges for oversight and trying to help charter schools be as effective as they can. We appreciate that and think it's very important to have an independent entity as an oversight organization. If they can also sponsor, does that lead to a conflict of interest? And so just something we would mention. Finally, we, of course, since we do represent educators in the state of Minnesota, we do believe current law is the appropriate measure for determining the majority of board members. We recognize right now that current law allows for a waiver. We believe that to be sufficient. It does allow the flexibility that the charter school boards may, in fact, want, but it does still allow us to be key players in the process. I did appreciate the testimony a few days ago. I appreciated what you had to say, and we just wanted to add a couple questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I have a question, Ms. Bloom, regarding the waiver process. I know the question or the concern has been that they have a waiver, and I'm not sure for how long, but wondering if there couldn't be some middle ground with that to say for those charters that have requested a waiver that it would be a permanent waiver until such time as they may want to, you know, go back. If the one example was the very small charter that had 3 teachers and that was it, maybe there's some way that we can work with that issue and maybe, you know, have some middle ground. But that's just a suggestion, and the author may want to, you know, think about that.
I appreciate
Thank
that,
you.
Madam Chair.
The next testifier is Mr. Aronson from the Minnesota High School League and Principals Association. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Roger Aronson. I represent the Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals and the Elementary Principals Association of the High School League. We're here to talk about Representative Klinzing's bill in 1921. I don't recall if this is the third or the fourth time that we've talked about various provisions of this bill with this committee or the full committee as well. So. I do want to make clear, too, I understand that this will probably progress since it seems to be a governor's initiative and this committee and these members have looked favorably on this as well in the past. We are strongly opposed to the provisions in 1921, particularly the modifications of the extracurricular provisions that are contained in the bill. A couple of things for the record that we want to make sure that the committee understands. First of all, charter schools get funds and are allowed to provide these activities under current law. There are no limitations on charter schools for providing the same range of extracurricular activities that are made available to students who are in traditional public schools. The second part of that is that to the extent there are, have been some limitations based on the size in charter schools, public schools have made significant accommodations for them. As we represented to the committee last year when we talked about this, a major modification of high school league rules to make it significantly easier to form cooperative sponsorships, particularly in the urban settings where there are multiple schools, was passed by the High School League Representative Assembly in November. A copy of that was put in your packets last Thursday. We had the executive from the High School League and from the secondary principals as well. They both are out of town today. I understand it didn't make it in the packets again this time, but it's a major change that would allow charter schools to enter into multiple cooperative sponsorships. It takes care of a problem which existed a couple of years ago that you heard about, where there was a student who was ineligible, a charter school student who played on the basketball team at South High School. One of the problems with this bill on its face is that its scope is much broader than you would think when you first look at it. This will require the public school to provide, not in an agreement with the school, but with any charter school student who shows up, the wide range of extracurricular activities that we currently provide. What we did not talk about in the past are specifically activities such as dances. Dances are security problems for public schools. We have very significant issues at dances and evening activities, and students aren't allowed to come to them without a proper ID. Under this statute, you would require that we provide these activities to students who are not enrolled in our school. We don't want to do that. First of all, we think it's a bad policy decision, and on the second hand, as one of the senior high school principals in Minnesota expressed in reviewing the bill, this would be a security nightmare for us as well. On the sports part of...
Mr. Aronson,
yes?
You know, I know you guys don't like this,
okay,
but...
That was coming through, Manager.
This is kind of stretching the envelope when, you know, if they've had some agreements now, some pairing agreements with, let's say, sports, and I don't know if you do background checks on the kids before they're allowed to swim with a swim team, or I don't know how those pairing agreements work, but I would think that if an ID is issued to your kids, that probably an ID would be issued to a charter school kid if they were going to participate as fully as you're describing. But I understand you have to anticipate all of the, you know, possibilities of people requesting to go to those things. But sometimes we do not look at the possibilities, and we just put up the barriers without really trying to do this in a way that's with a community spirit. But that's my comment, and you know I'm making it to you respectfully, Mr. Aronson.
Madam Chair, my experience and my client's experience have always been being treated with respect in this committee, and I appreciate that. That doesn't happen everywhere, and so we like to have that here as well. But these are the implementation pieces of this. If we don't come and talk to you about them now, and these are, that's not to suggest that all charter schools are bad or all charter school students would be security problems, you know, to that extent. But these are students who for some reason chose not to be in our schools. Some of them didn't succeed in our schools. And rather than saying the charter school has to come in the spirit of cooperation and work with our public school, this bill says let's go outside of that, that the public school no longer has any voice in these decisions. This fully vests these children with these rights to come and access these programs. Let me step through a couple of the problems as this is structured. What we've tried to do is encourage charter schools to either offer their own activities or to cooperatively sponsor with public schools. if you adopted this, a student would be able to play on two teams. He could play on his charter or her charter school team and on the public school team as well. The new rule that we adopted said that students can enter into the single residency cooperative sponsorship provided their charter school doesn't offer the activity. This bill actually would give charter schools an incentive not to offer those activities, not to try to be in conferences, not to enter into relationships with districts, and we think that's bad. People work hard to work these things out. I know that you had some testimony last week about Northfield. The Northfield Public School District worked hard with the new charter school in Northfield to set up cooperative sponsorships to allow those students to participate on the Northfield Public School teams. The fact of the matter in that was that the charter school was disorganized, didn't know how to do it, didn't get the forms to the public school district on time, and as a result of the activities director and the high school league's extensions of the deadlines, ultimately it worked. If you let us work through the current system, we can do these things. In addition, I mean, I know it is on the more technical provisions of this, but the way the bill is structured, the school district that's offering the activity, their disciplinary rules do not apply to the charter school student. It's the charter school's rules. So if the district says we have a zero tolerance policy that says if you've committed an alcohol violation once and you're off the team, the statute that you're looking at enacting here says it's the charter school's rules that apply to that particular student.
Madam Chair. Madam Flensing.
Thank you. To that, I was going to do it later, but I do have an author's amendment, very brief.
All right.
Why
don't we go ahead and look at that?
Okay. It's to fix that problem.
All right. What page?
Bottom of page 1, line 28. Mm-hmm. We would like to strike charter schools. Flip the page to page 2, line 1. Delete the period, insert of the resident district, period. What this would do is raise the conduct requirements to the, or actually expect the student to meet the conduct requirements of the resident district as opposed to the charter school.
All right. Representative Heiger, can you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point, yes. I see this as also opening it to private school students as well then. Am I correct or wrong, Mr. Arneson? Make that change.
Madam Chair, Representative Heckman, I wouldn't conclude that. They still have to be charter school students.
Right. The sentence reads, Mr. Representative Heiger, and charter school students participating in extracurricular about private.
Okay.
All right.
But that's charter school.
Any other questions? All right. All in favor? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Segrin. Mr. Aronson, would not Minnesota High School League rules apply, though, in all activities that are sanctioned by the league?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Aronson.
The problem that poses another one of the problems on the bill, Representative Erickson. Some of the charter schools belong to the Minnesota State High School League, and some of them don't. And the way that this would reconfigure this, it's no longer the school cooperating with one of the Minnesota public schools. The students now have individual rights to come into the public school. So if we have a non-member charter school, the students that are in that charter school are not subject to the high school league's rules. And so it does pose that problem as well. The high school league rules in those circumstances, some of them belong and some of them don't. So,
Mr. Aronson, how do we handle the homeschool? They have access, right? How do we do that with those kids?
Madam Chair, the homeschool children have the direct right of access to come and participate. And so exactly in that fashion.
They have to abide by the school's rules as...
Yes, the homeschools do, yes.
Yeah, okay. So they have to abide by the academic and other rules, and then they have to abide by the high school league rules, too?
Well, Madam Chair, in the same fashion, the homeschools actually belong to the high school league. Because they have such limited fundings, we waive the fees, the costs for them to belong. Mm-hmm. So they do belong, and in that fashion, then the rules apply to them.
I see. All right. Mm-hmm. But they have direct access as individual students.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Seeger. Mr. Erickson, could not the same thing be done for charter schools that you've done for homeschooling in the high school league realm?
Mr. Erickson, I'm not sure what you mean. Waive the fee or let them have access?
Madam Chair, access. Yes, and to have them as a part of the high school league in the same way that you've allowed homeschoolers to be part of the high school
Mr.
league.
Mr. Erickson.
I don't care if they don't waive the fee, but...
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, several of the schools are members, of the charter schools are members, and are offering activities, and as you all know from your experiences, some of these activities are very easy to offer. It's not particularly hard to offer mm-hmm. a golf team or a track team or a tennis team or, you know, those individual sports at some of the larger hockey arenas, football fields that are more problematic. So they do already belong. But we've made them function as schools in their relationship with other schools for participating in the process. Just wrap this up, Madam Chair, in a couple of issues. One of the policy questions that we differ on,
Before we do that, yes. we didn't vote on this.
No, you didn't.
So let's do that. Representative Klinzing moves to amend House File 1921, line 28, on page 1, strike charter schools, and then on page 2, line 1, strike the period, insert after requirements of the resident district, period. All in favor? Any questions about that? All in favor of this amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposition? The amendment is adopted. All right, now we can go on to your rest of yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two final small points on this. One of the points is, while this does provide for some language that says that the charter school will now be responsible for the cost on this activity, it doesn't provide how we get paid. Is this something that is the department going to send the money to us? Do we send the charter school a bill? When does that come? What happens if it's not paid? Those kinds of issues. I did ask Melcher.
Mr. Ernst, how does it work now when you have a pairing agreement?
When we have a pairing agreement, we have an agreement between the two schools, uh-huh. and a bill goes and it gets paid. But this agreement isn't with the school. In fact, the charter school may not even know that the child's come.
Okay.
I know the charter schools strongly support this. I think mm-hmm. that their zeal to do this are going to cause some problems for them, which one of those being now the charter school would make a decision about, are we going to cooperatively sponsor in what can we afford, hockey, basketball, etc. The way this happens, the students pick the activities and they go. The charter school doesn't play any role in saying whether they can go or not, and they're going to get a bill and they're going to have to pay us. So it's going to be one of those questions. And if the bill isn't paid, do we get to say to the child, you don't get to play?
Mm-hmm.
Or do we say next year you don't get to play? And I assume if this is going to be implemented, mm-hmm. some of those questions will come up.
Could be addressed. I agree. And Representative Klinzing, you're hearing some of those comments, and maybe you have some comments back.
Yes, I responded to this last time, too, that we have kids moving in and out of districts all the time, and that there are teams that belong to the Minnesota State High School League regardless.
Something, yes. Can you wait just a minute? I'm sorry. I keep forgetting. I wanted to recognize the ninth grade class from New Prague High School. Sorry, I didn't get to see you, but thank you so much for coming. You've heard a little bit of snippets of what's going on. Enjoy your day. All right, go ahead, Representative Klinzing. Sorry to interrupt you.
Well, I've had the experience I'm in both as a coach for a debate team in a regular public high school and in a public charter school. And our experience in the public school, regular public school, was that we had kids moving in and out of the program all the time, and it was just as difficult to prepare the funding in that situation. I don't think we can write into legislation every little fear that we might have that maybe the program will be too smaller or larger than the year before. It's just something that coaches usually learn to deal with, and schools do too. When we put our budgets together 6 months or 12 months before the activity starts the following year. In the charter school, we did a lot of interviewing of students before they came in. I would just guess that this would become an interview question and an application question before they enter the school, so that the school board can adjust their budget to begin to plan for these things. So that would be my response, that I don't think it necessarily needs legislation.
Mr. Aronson, are you finished with your comments?
Madam Chair, just one last piece that we wanted to put in the record, and that's that on a policy matter, the ultimate effect of this is for the kids that are on the bottom tiers of athletic teams, they're going to get bumped out by non-enrolled students. And this is where we significantly part company with the proponents of this bill. We think that the students that are enrolled in the school should have a preference for those positions, not that they should have to compete with non-enrolled students who are going to school somewhere else. The students who are in our schools that we have visited with agree with that as well. They don't think that the bottom-tier kids in these classes, to the extent that there are spaces that are unavailable. If this bill said that public schools will take spaces that are unavailable and try to make, or that are available and try to make them available for charter schools, that'd be something else, but it doesn't say that. This has a very broad scope. So some of our kids will get bumped from the musical. The Northfield example is one I talked with the principal about there yesterday, because they have this new high school there. Northfield every other year has a music extravaganza with 100 slots in it that are highly contested and auditioned for. They feel the students that are enrolled there should have the preference for those slots. And this bill basically says, you might be enrolled here, but you're going to get bumped. You may be bumped by somebody from another school. We think that's bad policy. And Madam Chair. So thank you very much. I appreciate coming again this year to go over this with you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Madam Chair, one final comment. Thank you. There's a distinction being made here that the students that aren't in public schools aren't public school students. That is an erroneous, I think, statement. They are public school students. And in some districts, they are actually on the teams with these kids through the community ed program until ninth grade, where they suddenly become a school-based program only, and then they are being told that they have to be kicked off the team because they've chosen a different public school. I think it's a very unfair setup to exclude these kids for that reason. I think the security nightmare is an exaggeration. Mm-hmm. When students want to bring kids from other school districts to a dance, there's a procedure in place at schools for those students to be able to bring those kids in. So it seems to me that the same procedure could be used if a student wanted to attend from an area from who lives in that district who might go to a different school. So I'm not sure that we don't already have procedures in place to deal with those security issues.
All right. Mr. Meeks, if you would like to come up and testify, and then we need to move on to our next.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm Bob Meeks of the Staff School Board Association. If Roger didn't get a gold star, I probably won't either. But I can tell you, 60-plus of the charter schools are members of mine. They pay a service fee. They don't pay dues. They pay a service fee. So we're not anti-charter school. But that being said, my delegate assembly did act. And we think it's wrong to go this route. But if you're going to do it, in your wisdom, if you think this is the route you want to go, we think there's certain things you got to address, and we can't say because this is how it happened in one school, that's how it happens statewide. It doesn't happen that way. And the reason we got to bring some of these issues forward is because if we don't, we're going to be back here trying to address some of these issues after something happens. So, Madam Chair, and I have a seat, I don't know what amendments are going to be offered. I was going to bring up the issue about operating under two sets of rules. You've addressed that one. You've addressed the issue about the students' residence, so we thank you, but we think there's some others. I suggest that instead of saying proportional costs, you should say direct and indirect costs. Let's make it clear what we're talking about. That the charter school shall pay before the student participates, not after, so we have to go after bill collectors or something, but before the direct and indirect costs. The issue of activities limited to the high school league, we think that's where you should go, because then you don't get into the dance or the some of the others. And it's kind of interesting. I noticed that this week Representative Greiling is going to be talking about a new charter school high school league. So I don't know how that plays into this particular bill, or if they're going to have their own rules or regulations or their own activities, which I think is the right way to go. I congratulate you on doing that, and I congratulate the association on setting up a high school league, and I think that's where the activity should take place, unless they come under the joint sponsorship program, which is the one that the state high school league sets up. Also, I suggest that the transportation of a charter school student is an issue, and who provides it and who pays the cost. Also, Madam Chair, I think we need to make it clear in the bill that we have the right to demand certain information, so that we can make a determination about the eligibility of the child, and even if the child is one of our residents, as an example. It should be clear that the charter school student is not guaranteed participation. If we have a tryout program, they have to try out just like everybody else. And I think that many of these things we agreed to last year. I was a little surprised to see the bill go back to where I guess we were 2 or 3 years ago rather than where I thought we were last year. And finally, I think... you talked about that. I got that. Let me just say that, you know, there, and I said this before, and I'll wrap it up. There are some circumstances, and there are some responsibilities that come with choice. And choices are being made all the time. And we support the right of the pupils and the parents to make those choices. But there's also ramifications for choices. I feel kind of good. My daughter's a junior. And by the way, she loved the high school page program. That was the best thing that ever happened to her. She actually reads the newspaper again now and looks at some of those issues. So thank you very much for that program. But I'm kind of glad that she's a junior and going to be a senior, because she's a marginal speech team member. And she's one of those that if the right students came along, she'd be bumped. And it's been a great experience for her, and I would be very mad if she got bumped, and I'd be back up visiting with you again. So I think that's going to happen to some parents. I think some parents are going to be here, and I think you should just get ready for that. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Meeks?
Thank you,
all right.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Meeks. This bill is being laid over for consideration for the K-12 omnibus bill. I would direct the author to maybe look at some of the other suggestions that have come forward today, working with some of the comments to see if there might be some clarifications on transportation or some of the other issues that may have been brought up that would make this bill just a really stellar bill. All right. The next group up is the Colin Powell Youth Leadership Center capital budget request. There is no bill for the committee. If you're wondering about language, this was actually referred to us from, I think, economic development in our committee. Yeah. If you will identify yourself for the tape, whoever wants to go first and speak.
My name is Art Erickson, and I'm the president of Urban Ventures. I've lived and worked in the Central Phillips neighborhood for 36 years, and we're looking at a sheet, this presentation right here, and I'm asking you to go to the second page.
All right, second page.
This is an overview of South Minneapolis. We do three things in this area. We do kid youth leadership development, we do economic development, and we do family strengthening. If you would look at this map, you will see the downtown area, number 2. You would see the Sears Building, number 9. And you would see A, B, C, and D are 4 schools. These are elementary schools in our area. Now, what is our area? If you would look at 5, that is the old Sears Building, which is now Wells Fargo Mortgage. If you come a block down from there, we are in this area that we'll show you in just a minute. If you put a pin in that area and go out a radius mile, you will find 46,000 people and 18,000 young people. This is an area that that we're looking at in this mile that we call a donut paradigm. That is, the resources are outside and a donut hole is in the middle here. And that is where a lot of the crime and a lot of the problems occur. Our school kids in this area are 94% poverty guideline. And this is where the state troopers have been called in to help out our local police. If you go to the next page, you will see a outlined area that we call the Opportunity Zone. And in that Opportunity Zone, or the Oz, we have the cluster of buildings where we've taken 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. We have a model block that we've worked on. 2 and 3 are our soccer fields that we developed and put $1.7 million in. And number 4 is the site of the Colin Powell Center. The next page is the need.
Sir, Mr. Erickson,
yes.
Do that again quickly. You have some infrastructure there again.
I'm sorry.
Number 5 is your headquarters.
Yes.
Number
2 and 3 are the soccer fields that we built out.
Okay.
Just south of the old Honeywell and now Wells Fargo. And number 4 is a block that we have purchased and is the site of the Colin Powell Center.
Okay. And so 6 is your Kitchen of Opportunity. That is part of your group?
That's part of our group. It's an economic development piece.
People's Exchange and the Learning Lab, all of that.
Right.
All of
the Learning Lab, the Fathering Center,
all right,
et cetera. The next page is really the need and the problem that we're here addressing. And that is that 47% of Minneapolis public school kids graduated from high school last year. And from the area I just showed you, it's probably more like 33%. And then it deteriorates in terms of percentage. The graduation rate for African American students is 32%, for Hispanic students 32%, for American Indian students 27%, and 23% for African American males. We have the largest disparity between black and white students of any state. And 43.5% of all juvenile detainees in the state of Minnesota come from Hennepin County. And a large portion of those come from the Phillips and Central area. And these are the economic costs that affect us in the state and affect you. And we'll talk about these now.
My name is Stephanie Carlson. I've been a public high school teacher both in Colorado and in Boston. When I was teaching in Colorado, my second year of teaching, Columbine happened. My third year of teaching, I had a student leave my seventh period world history class and go home and shoot himself. So as a teacher, very early on in my teaching career, I was made acutely aware of how important those after-school hours are, and what happens within a family really does affect what goes on in the classroom. With 50 minutes of teaching every day as a world history teacher, there's only so much I can do. After much discussion and planning, we have come to the goal of the Colin Powell Center, which is that each youth involved in the programs would graduate from high school and go on to some form of post-secondary education. We've been talking with the Wilder Foundation. We've been in discussion with members at the University of Minnesota at the Hubert Humphrey Institute, trying to hone down and make sure that we have the data that we need and the processes that we need to measure this outcome. The next slide that you'll see up there is the artist's rendering of the outside of the building. We are in the process right now of going through construction documents. What I'd like to focus on is the floor plan that you see here with the three levels of the program building. The building has a program aspect to it and a gym. We're looking at the program part right now. The icons on here represent the different organizations that have agreed to be a part of the Colin Powell Youth Leadership Center. So we're standing here, but we're representing seven separate independent youth organizations that have been operating successful programs in the Twin Cities areas for an average of 19 years each. The first one up here, Youth Frontiers, they do work with suburban schools now. They work with about 75,000 students a year. Their particular goal is to affect school climate. Moving on down in that same floor, we have the Arts Us Education Program that is working out of Concordia College at the moment. They will be doing performing arts programming around African drumming, singing, spoken word, and those kinds of performing troupes that could then go out into the community. Moving on down, we have the Page Education Foundation, which is centered on providing scholarships for youth. Once we have them graduating from high school, obviously there's a huge need for resources, and this partner has agreed to join us on that aspect. The Kids Cafe will be operated by Perspectives Family Center out of St. Louis Park. They've been operating one now for years. It's been incredibly successful. The additional component to the Kids Cafe model here will be a nutrition and food and education program. As many of you may know, in minority neighborhoods, there's a high incidence of type 2 diabetes and obesity. We want to address those issues while kids are young and bring their parents in, so not only will we be feeding them, but we'll be talking about long-term, lifelong, healthy eating habits. Moving on across, there's INROADS. It's a national organization that provides mentoring specifically for minority youth into corporate headquarters so that they are prepared for management-level positions when they graduate from high school. They are going to be running their grades 9 through 12 component in the Colin Powell Center because they are unable to find enough qualified seniors to meet the demand in the Twin Cities. On the lower left-hand corner is the Minnesota Air National Guard. We are thrilled to have them a part of the program because they offer 106 career fields, training in 106 career fields out at Fort Snelling. They are committed to bringing in things like Hummers or an aircraft engine on a weekend so to get kids excited about these ideas and then do some more specific career training once the kids get old enough. Moving on up to this one, this is the Learning Lab. This is one of the programs that Urban Ventures operates. We're working with youth specifically to get them up to their age level in reading and math using technology. Life Coaches is a mentoring program that we also run. And then Communities and Schools, this is, some of you may be familiar with it. This is quite a complex project. We are still in discussion, hoping that this will be part of the Colin Powell Youth Leadership Center. Flipping over, this is the last one. This is the aerial view of the building. There are four gyms. One of the reasons we wanted to build four gyms is we have an enormous athletic program that is having very difficult time trying to find athletic space. This is one of the biggest draws for kids right now, and we want to make sure that we can have that capacity for them and for our athletic programming. As you saw on the aerial map before, we do have the two soccer fields, which is...
My name is Dwayne Coleman, and I'm overseeing the development effort for the Colin Powell Center. Why don't we take a look specifically at the cost page, and that's up on your screen right now. With regards to how much the facility will cost, $12.7 million. We currently raised $5 million, and we have $7.7 million remaining. This is with regards to the facility. And so with regards to the request for $4.2 million, specifically, if you were to grant us that request, that would bring our remaining amount down to $3.47 million. So your gift will have a significant impact with regards to making the Colin Powell Center a reality. Our goal is to break ground September 9th, and so that's why this is so important with regards to being able to impact the kids in Central and Phillips and throughout the state of Minnesota with regards to some of the costs that we'll discuss a little bit later. Okay, we just talked about the cost, but what are the costs of doing nothing? And I think this is even more important. In your packets are some of these studies that really validate what we're looking at with regards to the cost of doing nothing. Specifically, $1.7 to $2.3 million for each youth that leaves high school and lives a life of crime and drug abuse. This is based on a 1999 national study, and it's based on a career of 10 years, approximately 10 years. So for each youth, that's the cost of someone who goes out and does negative behavior over a career. Hennepin County currently spends $74,200 annually with regards to the group homes that they generally select for the kids that they participate, or at least allocate to group homes. They use an organization called Hearthstone in Minnesota, and that is the annual cost right there, $74,200 to be able to put those kids in. And I can tell you, the cost of a Harvard education is significantly less than that $74,200. The Hennepin County budget for juvenile corrections for 2003 was $52 million. And so we understand that this is actually low in comparison to all the other costs that are associated with juveniles that are incarcerated. The cost ultimately is more than money. Bottom line is, what we choose to do with these kids will impact not only the kids' lives, but also the state. Because we pay those tax dollars that go to incarceration, that go to public assistance for the kids that don't graduate from high school, and there's a direct correlation between high school graduation and incarceration and other forms of negative behavior. And so the key with regards to the financial aspect is that we believe it's important to get it on the front end to help these kids graduate, to give them a hope and a future so that ultimately they'll contribute to society as opposed to becoming a drain on society. So in summary, the Colin Powell Center will serve 25,000 kids annually. Significant impact with regards to the number of kids that will be touched by the programs. A collaborative effort between 7 independent organizations located throughout the Twin Cities. It's a single measurable goal, high school graduation leading to some form of post-secondary education. Phoenix and Memphis and other communities have expressed an interest in using the Colin Powell Center model. So this will truly be state-of-the-art. It's a model that's phenomenal because we believe collaboration, we can't do it all as Urban Ventures, but we know that if we partner with other organizations, it minimizes duplication and improves the effectiveness with regards to the programming. And with regards to recouping the cost, the $4.23 million investment that we're seeking from the state, we can cover that if we can prevent just three kids from dropping out of high school and living a life of crime and drug abuse. And so we're coming here to seek your help with regards to commitments. We have commitments from a number of corporations. We have commitments from individuals, foundations, and the federal government. And so we're seeking the state to really play its role with regards to impacting the kids in this neighborhood, because ultimately we pay for it one way or another. And the key is to be able to pay for it so the kids do positive things as opposed to negative things. Once again, it'll transform the neighborhood, but also we believe that we can reduce the need for some of the further additional investment with regards to juvenile justice programs and public assistance. And so I would like to also make one other point. We talked about the statistics with regards to graduation rates. We are a friend of the public school system. We believe that public schools are important. Most of the kids in our neighborhood will go to public schools. And so we're also an area learning center at this point in time. We do provide support for the public schools, but it's important to note that when kids get out of school, that's when they need the help. And after-school programs have proven to be effective ways of being able to impact the lives of kids. And kids that go to after-school programs, the attendance is higher, the graduation rate is higher, they tend to be more focused. And so that's really the need with regards to the program, and we're seeking your support for the Colin Powell Youth Leadership Center. Any questions?
Mr. Coleman, you mentioned that you are also a site for an ALC. Where's your ALC located right now?
It's in our learning lab.
It's the learning lab. So that would be located in your new building.
I think one of the neat things with regards to the learning lab that's important to note is that the Colin Powell Center will enable us to double our capacity with regards to touching more and more kids. And so the more kids that we touch that we can help graduate, the impact on the state and the community would be heightened.
Okay. We have a question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, have you looked at all at other sites, for example, existing buildings? We know that there may be some school closures in Minneapolis, and I was curious as to whether that has been considered at all.
There are no other buildings. We've looked quite a bit at this. I've lived there for 36 years, and I know the buildings. There are no other sites. The school closings are still way up in the air in terms of what's really going to happen there. We closed Central High School. We closed Bryan Junior High in our neighborhood. We closed Warrington Elementary. We closed Clinton. So we live in closed schools, and that's part of the problem is we bus out all over and come back into the neighborhood to nothing. So we've looked at other buildings.
Mr. Erickson, though, the question is, I know that there are four schools right around the area, Four Winds, Anderson, and Anderson Open Green, Central Park, and Banneker. Are any of those on the list of possible closures?
We simply don't know what's going to happen on that.
Okay, but were any of these on that list that was
Banneker is being looked at,
okay,
as a possibility, but then there's alternative at it being a high school. So it's
unsure yet. That it might turn into a high school?
That was one of the suggestions that Jennings had.
All right. Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Wardlow?
Yeah, Madam Chair, what's your experience with, you said that it's modeled after two other sites. What's their experience been? How is it? Because
Representative Wardlow, I think he said there were two other areas of the country that were interested in looking at their model.
Oh. Memphis and Phoenix are looking at this possibility.
You know, you haven't seen a model like this work anymore.
No.
So you're the front runners.
However, just to speak to that, working with the Wilder Foundation, they have found that when you co-locate organizations in one facility, especially if you're reaching kids, there's an increased network, what they call it. There's formal networks of people who apply for help, but then there's what's called informal networking, where there's stuff that happens in the hallway or around the water fountain, and those are the links that are really strengthened when you have organizations co-locating, and that's one of the reasons why we were looking at this model.
Mr. Erickson, too, or maybe one of the developer folks, what is the federal, I noticed that there are federal monies that are contributing to this. How much are the federal dollars?
$1.5 million for the Air National Guard part of the facility.
So that's the only federal amount?
Correct.
Wasn't there some other federal monies that were coming with some of these Colin Powell? I thought there was something else that was... Nothing else but the Air National Guard.
We are actually pursuing federal monies at this point in time, but nothing's been allocated. No decisions have been made.
Pardon again?
We're pursuing federal monies at this point, but no decisions have been made and no monies have been allocated outside of the Air National Guard.
All right. Okay. All right. Thank you. Any other? Okay. Representative Krenke and then Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You said that you have currently $5 million committed. That would be, if it's $1.5 million from the Air National Guard, then you also say you have corporations, individuals, and foundations. Could you give us a breakdown of what the money commitments are with those categories of corporations, individuals, and foundations?
Mr. Erickson?
Now, there's two parts that we're going for. We're showing you the capital investment. There's also an endowment part of this because we want to run this building. So there's actually a larger campaign, and so we're in front of some of the other foundations for both the endowment and the capital. We're in front of Target. We're in front of Good Best Buy. We're in front of General Mills. And these are companies that we're looking at right now.
We did receive the largest capital gift last year from Wells Fargo Bank, which is just north of where the Colin Powell Center will be located. We've had other organizations, ADC, actually the list goes on and on of corporations that have contributed. We also have had individuals who've given significant amounts of money. We've had one lead gift from an individual, who I won't mention his name, $1.85 million. And we actually have a list that we can provide you with, Phil. That'll show you all the contributors to the project.
Thank you.
Chair, if
that'd
we just,
Representative
I don't need to know names, I just need to know, as I said, if you give us a list of currently pledged money for the capital part of the project with regard to the breakout. Thank you.
Okay, and Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question I have, Minneapolis Public Schools, City of Minneapolis, and Hennepin County, what's their involvement?
What's their what?
Involvement.
We have been involved in the kids' lives of all those schools. We are involved with the school board in terms of we're an area learning center for them. And for Hennepin County, we have the Right Turn Project for the Fathering Center. But those are our involvements with them as collaboratives.
And Hennepin County also was the sponsor for this bill for the project. So,
okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Actually, my question was more about how are the Minneapolis schools or the city of Minneapolis or Hennepin County contributing toward this project, either financially, building-wise, anything at all? How are they contributing toward this project, all three of those?
Mr. Erickson?
The city is not. The Hennepin County is doing some of the cleanup work on some of the property, so we would be doing some of the work with them on that.
Okay. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, these kids are already being serviced piecemeal, and they're all going to be funneled into this school, or where the kids come from, that neighborhood or different schools around, or they come from outside?
Mr. Erickson?
They would come from the radius mile.
Just the radius mile, not outside of that.
Well, actually, though, with regards to one of the collaboratives, Youth Frontiers, they would bring kids in from the Minneapolis and St. Paul public schools. So Colin Paul Center would be open to any kid anywhere with no cost. So there are some programs that would bring kids in from wider radiuses.
Okay.
Yeah. Follow-up question?
Representative Wardlow, and this will be the last question.
So these kids would go to this school all day long, and
this is a center that's a container of collaboratives that would include a school,
right,
as one of the aspects.
Okay.
But it's really an after-school container.
Oh, but the learning center would be?
Would be both for the school and after school.
And the teachers are coming from, you got to hire them, or?
That would be depend if it's a communities and schools. It would be the public school system. If it were a charter school, it would come from our own hiring.
Mr. Erickson, you're running an ALC in conjunction with Minneapolis, though, right now.
Yes.
Correct, yeah.
Right.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. And this bill will be, or not, this isn't a bill, but this request will be before our committee for its consideration.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I just want to mention that there is a bill will be introduced and you'll have a number.
Okay. Well, it's really not necessary if you don't want to do that. We're going to skip around on the agenda just real briefly. I want to bring Mr. Wadle back up, and I hate to do this for a bill of my own. I like to put my stuff, last, but Mr. Wadle is going to have some commitments next week that won't be able to come back for testimony, so I'd like to get him on just because he will not be available in the future. Members, House File 2417, I'm going to move it before our committee for consideration. Mr. Wadle came to me about looking at creating a charter school that would include or incorporate educating preschool kids. And when he got into looking at the charter school law, there needed to be some clarifications. It would not indicate that if they had preschool kids that they would be paid for those like a regular kindergarten and on, but would be able to clarify that they can use whatever general ed monies they get to do some preschool programs, just like a regular school could do, a public school, other public schools can do. But the charter school law was unclear that they can do that, and so we wanted to make sure that there was that clarification. And then also that we would add a use for compensatory monies, that compensatory monies also could be used for pre-K programs. And that's kind of basically the bill. But Mr. Wadle, if you will kind of share your thoughts with the committee.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, for the record, I'm Bob Wadle. one of the goals that we all have is that the children will acquire the readiness skills that they need to be successful in school by the time they come to kindergarten. And we know that many children don't, especially children that have English as their second language, or kids that come from high concentrations of poverty, as well as other students. And we also know that we have considerable number of programs, whether it be child care or school readiness or other ECFE efforts, going on throughout our state, and those are
those are to be commended. But one thing that we really need is to kind of bring all those things together to really focus on readiness. And some of the charters are interested in operating programs that would really put these centers within the charter school, so that the literacy experts at the school would also be working with the early childhood people right there at that school. Right now, of course, early childhood programs are rarely in school buildings, at least not in the metropolitan area, and frequently they're not connected directly to a school. So our vision was that you have a common emphasis on literacy when children came to child care through grade 3, and there the objective, of course, would then be to make sure children were ready when they came to K with the readiness skills that we really know what those readiness skills are, and with that common curriculum would certainly then be on target by the end of third grade. Well, the law doesn't include provisions for charters to participate in preschool programs, even though the law does say that charters can serve students under the age of 5. And so one way to start doing that would be to make charters eligible to participate in the school readiness program. And so that's one of the amendments that you have before you. The second thing would be to enable any school, really, not just charters, any school, that if that site wanted to, that it could use some of its current compensatory revenue for early readiness programs, so that kids then would come to their kindergartens more ready than they currently are. Madam Chair, those are really the two provisions that are included in this bill. But going back again to the policy focus of literacy, that we ought not be separating our programs simply because somebody is younger than age 5, and somehow make that completely separate. This brings things together to accomplish that goal of literacy by kindergarten and then on target by the end of third grade.
And members, too, to clarify the compensatory expansion of uses for compensatory, it does specify, too, that it would have to be a preschool program that was using developmentally appropriate early literacy programs using research-based interventions to provide this kind of support for students in school. So it's not just a nebulous kind of a thing, but we really want to have good, solid programs being used. That's the essence of the bill. And we just wanted to bring that forward, and we will have that for consideration for the K-12 bill. Any questions? All right.
Madam Chair, if I could just add one other thing. Before, when I was testifying, I talked about sponsor-initiated schools.
Mm-hmm.
This would be an example where the sponsor would say, here are the kind of schools that we want. And how do we develop the kind of schools that we really want?
So there is the potential for that. Thank you, Mr. Wadle. We want to now squeeze in really quickly Representative Knobloch. We've been working on this issue in regard to the payment schedule and the tax recognition shift that was used last year for some of our budget reductions. We want to make sure that as we get some additional excess after we have, funded our K-12 programs, that there's any surplus in the second year of our biennium, that monies would be used to begin to pay back the tax recognition shift and the payment schedule before we use that money for rebates or anything else. And we just think that that's a fiscally responsible thing to do. Representative Knobloch, would you like to explain the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. Could you do me a favor and move that it be passed to the Tax Committee?
To be referred to the Tax Committee.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1970 provides that general fund dollars that would otherwise be designated for purposes like tax rebates must first be used to pay off the accounting shifts done over the past 2 years with the school payment shift and the property tax recognition shift. As members know, one of the techniques the state has used for managing past budget deficits is to delay or reduce payments to school districts through the use of the payment shift and the tax recognition shift. This technique was done in the early 1980s. It was done again in the early 1990s, and most recently and now in 2002 and 2003. Currently, under law, budget surpluses must first go toward restoring the budget reserve and second toward restoring the cash flow account. After that, if a surplus in excess of 0.5% of the general fund is reported in November of an even-numbered year or February of an odd-numbered year, the entire surplus must be allocated toward tax rebates. This bill would allocate these funds toward first paying off these shifts. Let me tell you exactly how it would work with real dates. A year from now, if the February 2005 forecast comes in and has a $1 billion surplus, we can do whatever we're going to do on it. We can cut taxes, we can raise spending, we can ever do whatever we want with that $1 billion. But after that, if we've got a surplus that shows up in, say, the February forecast beyond that, the 2006 February forecast, that budget surplus, let's say it's $100 million that develops if the economy keeps getting good, that would be dedicated toward paying off the payment shifts. This does not mean there could not be additional tax cuts or additional spending increases. You could cut other programs and have tax cuts. You could raise other taxes and have spending increases. But if $100 million shows up in the February 2006 forecast under this bill, that $100 million would go toward paying off these shifts until they're paid off. Members, it took approximately 20 years to fully repay the shifts that were done in the early 1980s. This bill provides a mechanism to avoid repeating that sorry history. I think it's a good bill for education, and I'd appreciate your support.
Representative Knobloch, one suggestion that I would have as I was looking at this is to maybe reverse your order of 3 and 4. And the only reason is that number 4 is less money that we could get paid off more quickly. With your 80-20 payment schedule, that thing may take, there's more machinations with that, and I would recommend that we reverse those and just get the other one done first. I forget how much, Mr. Crow, can you tell us how much the tax recognition shift is versus the 80-20?
Madam Chair, for the current biennium, if those were paid off, the tax shift would be about $270 million, and the to go to a 90-10 from 80-20 would be about $604 million.
Okay. So we could at least get one of them, I think, cleaned off of the books more quickly and then work on the 80-20.
Madam Chair, if you wanted to do that, that's fine with me.
And, oh, Representative Krinke, do you have a problem with that?
Madam Chair, just a question of Representative Knobloch. With the budget forecast coming out at the end of the week, do you have a provision in here to take more money from the tax recognition shift to solve the budget? Is that going to be an amendment when this gets to the tax committee?
Madam Chair, Representative Krinke, we certainly hope not. This bill would not affect whatever comes out in the February forecast. This would, of course, only take effect in future years and really wouldn't apply until after we were back here a year from now and had done the budget in the 2005 session for the next 2 years.
All right. Mr. Strom has a recommendation, too. We want to reverse the order. Mr. Crow, okay, whoever, one of you here. We want to reverse the order of the payment, but then, Mr. Crow, you had a suggestion also.
Well, Madam Chair, without making any predictions about what happens this session, on line 21, the phrase from 80% could be irrelevant if we change it to 85 or 75 or some other number. So it would work if it just says to not more than 90%. So if from 80% is stricken, the language still works, but it doesn't, it wouldn't need to be changed if we changed the the 80% this session.
Okay.
So
I would accept that as a friendly amendment.
All right. Representative Knobloch accepts that as a friendly amendment. Representative Greiling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it goes without saying, but, you know, Representative Seeger and I and Representative Mariani were here as we gradually unburied ourselves from these, and it's very wearying, and Representative Krinke, you know, to have to be looking at these kinds of numbers again, and I certainly strongly supported last year actually balancing the budget, which is constitutionally required. And I think this is just, you know, a kind of an interesting way to get around that constitutional requirement. But I hope, seriously, Representative Knobloch, that when and if we have another deficit on Friday, which, of course, we all are hearing that we are going to, that this year we will follow the principle of our Constitution and balance the budget and don't take it out of education funding anymore, because then we have to, you know, beg for money from the Ways and Means Committee, get it, and apply it to our debt. We don't have anything to show for it, and that isn't, you know, what our constitutional founding forefathers meant, I don't believe, when they said we have to constitutionally have a balanced budget. So I would plead with you, when we get the new deficit on Friday, that we don't take it out of the future for future students, but instead really balance the budget.
All right, we need to just vote on this change on line 21, strike from 80%. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposition? That amendment is adopted. Now, the next amendment would be to switch the order, and I guess we would just say 4 is 3 and 3 is 4.
Sounds good to me.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposition? That amendment is adopted. All right. This is going to be recommended to pass to the Tax Committee.
Yes, Madam Chair.
All in favor, say aye. Oh, sorry. Wait, well, we have Representative Bernardi then. Representative Bernardi, did you have a question about the bill?
Well, I didn't get a chance to find out in here. Is there anywhere this will this go against education spending? Is there anything in here that can spell out to the public that we're not spending these dollars on education when we do it? Because this is how, by doing what happened last session and making that shift, it creates the black hole syndrome. So when we do pay this off, let's say we could pay off $270 million, the public thinks we just spent $270 million on education. So, I mean, is there a way that we can really communicate to the public that we're paying off a debt from this last session?
Representative
Knobloch. Well, Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, I mean, I think that the bill speaks for itself. It talks about the shifts that are there, and I think that people need to just communicate the facts to the public.
All right, Representative Kroenke.
I just wanted a point of clarification that we do not have a constitutionally required balanced budget amendment. The Constitution says that we cannot borrow for what is essentially long-term operating expenses. We can short-term borrow, but we can't. At the end of every biennium, we have to be even with the bank for operating expenses. So
all right.
That's how we, this is one of those little caveats that we found around around the Constitution, so to speak. But
And that was, I think, to Representative Greiling's point.
We can go short-term borrow, folks, if we don't want to be fiscally responsible. Or we can long-term borrow.
All right. we want to move this to with recommendation to the Tax Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposition? House File 1970, as amended, is passed and referred to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
This meeting is adjourned.
Not like this.